Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to hear another reaction to Prince's death in a few minutes here. This one from Seattle writer Ijeoma Oluo, a self-described black weirdo, and we're going to talk about what that means and what Prince meant to her in about 10 minutes. But we're going to start this hour with inequality in Seattle schools. 2 years ago, a KUOW investigation found a big disparity in the amount of recess kids get at different Seattle grade schools. Kids at low-income schools tended to get far less recess than kids at wealthier schools. Since that report, the school district agreed to a minimum amount of recess, 30 minutes a day. But KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld says whether kids get that much time or any recess at all is often up to their teacher.
Desmond Collins is in fourth grade. He loves recess.
I usually play with my friends Rosie and Camilo and Ty.
Their favorite game is Epic Fails. That's basically competitive slapstick.
If there's monkey bars, you purposely slip off and fail on as much as you can.
But Desmond says sometimes he doesn't get to go to recess.
Lots of times, actually.
He says his teacher is pretty strict.
For example, once I got up to get a drink of water, but she gave me detention, and detention is staying in for all of recess, so I didn't get any recess at all.
Withholding recess is common practice in Seattle public schools and a lot of districts. Sometimes kids are kept in for punishment, other times to finish an assignment. Carly Nelson teaches third grade at Lowell Elementary School on Capitol Hill. She says when teachers don't have a lot of discipline options, letting kids know that recess is at stake can work.
I think that some kids are scared that they're going to get in trouble, and so then they make good choices. I need to follow the rules because I don't want to miss any of my recess time.
But what's been a popular discipline tactic for decades is now falling out of favor.
I can see how it's absolutely tempting for teachers to hold recess as a form of punishment because it is such a valued currency by the children. But I think for so many reasons, that's absolutely the wrong thing to do.
Pooja Tandon is a pediatrician and researcher at Seattle Children's and the University of Washington. She points to the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendation that recess never be withheld for discipline or academic reasons.
There's lots of evidence that the opportunity to run around and play and to get that break that children get when they get recess is associated with better behavior, better learning, better attention.
Withholding recess is banned in 10 states. Our state education department also recommends against keeping kids in. But it's still allowed in Seattle public schools. Erin Romanek oversees the district's discipline policies.
We know that research shows that withholding recess for students isn't necessarily effective in certain cases. We also know that sometimes our students who need recess the most are the ones who maybe kind of find themselves in that situation where they're not earning their recess.
Still, Romanek says there can be good reasons to keep kids in.
I do know that sometimes schools use that time to kind of teach, you know, social skills, to kind of build up what does success look like for that student, to kind of coach and model behaviors so they can be more successful and actually enjoy being out at recess.
It's unknown how often students are kept in from recess in Seattle or across Washington. Even though districts are required to collect discipline data and report it to the state, losing recess is typically between a teacher and a student. Some Seattle teachers we spoke to say it's a more common form of punishment at low-income schools, and that in their experience, kids of color are disproportionately kept in. If that's true, that means the district's new policy requiring at least 30 minutes of recess a day doesn't actually level the playing field between rich and poor, black and white, as much as it was meant to.
Tomorrow's gonna be very hot.
Back at Lowell Elementary, Principal Jerry Guerrero is monitoring kindergarten recess. She says kids get a lot out of recess, from working on social skills to experiential learning.
So I see recess as an instructional time.
Illustrating her point, a kindergartner runs toward her waving a clump of dirt.
Diamond.
You found a diamond? In the rough.
The boy shows off a glittering clod.
Is that what you're looking at? The shiny things?
Yeah.
What do you think that is?
I don't know.
Are you bringing it to class to ask your teacher?
To see what it is.
All right. That's a great discovery.
Guerrero says Lowell staff see recess as so valuable to kids that they recently voted to stop using it as a bargaining chip.
Historically, recess has always been used as a leverage to get students to get their work done. And what we found is that doesn't necessarily work. It actually backfires on both the student and the teacher.
Lowell teacher Carly Nelson says it's been years since she took recess away from a student.
To be honest, it was like a punishment for me because then I would have to tell a student, go stand on the wall and you can't play. And then I would kind of have to keep an eye on the student and make sure that they weren't. And if they did go play, then I had to go deal with it. And then in the end, it felt like I don't even know if they learned to change their behavior, because then whatever reason they were out there in the first place, they might go back and do it again.
But Nelson says if you're going to take away one discipline strategy, you need to come up with a new one.
And the emphasis on that, I feel, is very important. Instead of just saying, well, we can't use recess as a consequence, then I feel like you need to have a plan. Well, what are we going to do to help the students learn to make good choices?
At Lowell, Nelson says they're using a lot of new strategies. Teachers and students take 30 minutes a day to talk about good behavior and put the emphasis on that, not on punishment. Seattle Public Schools just started looking at its discipline policies to make sure they're fair and equitable. But the district says there are no plans to look at the practice of withholding recess. In Seattle, I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
That is a look at inequality in Seattle schools. Now we turn to equality on our currency. Does it sound like a triumph of justice that Harriet Tubman is going to replace Andrew Jackson on the front of the $20 bill? A lot of people were celebrating yesterday's announcement, but not Seattle-based writer Ijeoma Oluo.
I am at a point now where I no longer celebrate these kind of empty symbolic gestures. I am looking now, 400 years that we've been on this continent, for more substantive moves towards racial equality than this.
You've said that we're putting Harriet Tubman's face on the symbol of her oppressor. How was Harriet Tubman oppressed by money? What do you mean by it?
I think that, one of the fundamental misunderstandings about the history of slavery and racism in America is we think that it is sentiment driven, that there's this group of white people who, for some reason, just really hated black people. But the truth is that it's an economic system within which racism was invented to justify it. So we had a system that relied on cheap and free labor in order to drive the early economy of this country. And racism and all of that was basically created to justify what would otherwise be unjustifiable, which is, making human beings into cattle. Harriet Tubman's life was bought and sold for money. In fact, when she and her brothers escaped, it was offered up $300 reward for her and her brother's return. So basically, for five of the $20 bills that her face is on, her freedom could have been taken from her once again. So, to put her on the face of this very system that consistently was oppressing and enslaving her, I don't feel like it's a proper tribute. I don't think that tying people to this system that itself is the reason why we are in the state we are in is ever a proper tribute.
Are we even gradually making American capitalism more worthy of Harriet Tubman?
I think that when we currently have the average white person with 12 times the net worth of the average black person, it's really hard to say yes to that. Yes, slavery has been abolished and it has instead been replaced by a prison industrial complex that has, even more black people behind bars still giving free labor to the state. The truth is these $20 bills with Tubman's face on it are going to go to far more people who look like her oppressor than they will to the people who could really use it.
Since you're talking about symbolism, can't we also see this as Harriet Tubman's symbolic victory over her oppressor? And by the way, the slaveholder Indian killer Andrew Jackson has to move to the back of the bus, the back of the $20 bill?
I don't know. I would say, I was talking with my brother about this yesterday, and he said, we can't even have our own bill. We got to have roommates. Since when do we have to share a bill with our slaveholders? Why would we ever think that it would be okay to have a freed slave, share space in the afterlife with a slaveholder and, someone responsible for the genocide of, hundreds of thousands of Native Americans as well? It just, to me, that's not what honoring someone looks like.
Ijeoma, in a way, I think this new $20 bill is not aimed at you. You already thought about these issues. It's aimed at the rest of America.
You know, one thing I would definitely say is we could have been honoring Harriet Tubman. We've had over 100 years since her death to really have, you know, substantive talks about her work, not only as a freedom fighter for Black people, but as a suffragette, you know, at everything that she stood for. She was a very complicated and smart and proud woman of action, not of symbolism. And the truth is that our kids still only learn about her maybe a paragraph or two every February, and that's it. And as a society, we could have been, you know, really standing up and saying, we stand for these same values. We stand for equality and justice. I mean, this is a woman who died penniless, but still donated all that she had for the care of poor Black people. We could have been honoring her so much better than this, than just putting her face on the money that Black people don't have.
How should we honor Harriet Tubman and equality and justice?
I think that we can honor her by continuing her mission of helping to free Black people in America. And we can do that by taking a look at our school-to-prison pipelines. We can look at the way in which our capitalist system currently funds the oppression of people of color. We can look at our court systems and how, you know, they oppress people of color. We can look at where we're putting jobs in what communities. We can look at the infrastructure that we're building around Black communities. She built a railroad to free Black people, and we need to build infrastructure in Black communities in order for Black people to truly be free.
Ijeoma Oluo is a Seattle-based writer. We asked her here to our studio because of her article in The Guardian arguing that putting Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill doesn't go far enough. But right before Ijeoma came to our studio, she had just been tweeting about the death of Prince. In case you haven't heard, the music icon passed away earlier today. So I asked her how she was handling that news.
I am still in shock. I'm really sad, and I'm probably going to continue to, you know, go deeper into heartbreak as the day goes on. It's not something that I think I thought was possible. I don't think that a lot of people thought Prince would ever die, and certainly not this soon. The man is magic and has been, and what he has meant to music lovers, to Black people around America and around the world is just unbelievable. His legacy, I don't even think it's been fully measured, because we always thought we would have him. I don't think we ever thought we would have to add up what he meant to us, because I don't think we thought he was going anywhere. You know, there were always these celebrities that we thought maybe we should prepare in case something happens. But I don't think anyone ever thought Prince was going to go anywhere.
What do you mean by what he meant to Black Americans?
You know, to see someone command the screen the way that Prince did. And Prince has always been unapologetically himself. He never let anyone define him. He never let anyone define his Blackness either. And, you know, there is so much pressure on celebrities, especially celebrities of color, to fit into a certain stereotype and to act a certain way so that white audiences and mainstream audiences are more comfortable with how they look. But, you know, we had a flamboyant, hypersexual, incredibly multi-talented artist who would wear pants with the butt cut out because he could, and, you know, made amazing music for artists of all genres, not just his own music. And he never once apologized or explained or felt like he had to have a conversation about it. And it was accepted. Nobody ever questioned it. And the truth is as a Black woman, you know, today, my Blackness is constantly questioned. If I do anything that seems, quote unquote, not quite Black, people are asking me, is this because you're from Seattle? You know, is this because you're light skinned? Nobody ever questioned Prince. And he gave, you know, what we like to call Black weirdos a sense of freedom that we really hadn't had before.
Are you a Black weirdo?
Yes. Yes, I am. And it's not something I ever sought out. It was just, you know, by nature of being who I am, a 6 foot tall, loud, lispy, artistic, light skinned Black woman, it can be hard to find your place. And I think Prince was one of those people who stood out as a beacon for, you know, your Blackness stands and you can claim it and nobody can ever take that from you.
Ijeoma Oluo, Seattle based writer. She was remembering Prince. Full name, Prince Rogers Nelson. And the news broke today that Prince has passed away. We don't know the cause of death yet. He was 57 years old. You're listening to KUOW's The Record.
This will be the day you will hear me say. For you.
do. Tell me what you're gonna do.
What is Seattle's boom going to look like in the University District? Urban historian Margaret O'Meara was part of a group that created the University District Strategic Plan. That's the city's plan for that neighborhood's growth. She wants to see taller buildings, more people, and tech startups in the U District. That wish list worries Tasso Lagos. His family ran the Greek restaurant, the Continental, on the Ave for 40 years. He doesn't want to see development push out community.
My family took over the restaurant in 1974, and then about 3 years ago, my father and mother decided to retire. So within that space of time, I really got to know people who were return customers, even people from KUOW would come. And you have
I've been to the Continental many times, Tasso.
There you go. So you know something about sort of having this anchor point that is a place you can, is a respite from the weary world, you might say, a place to kind of get away for a while and to just have someone smile at you and know your name, know what you're going to order. And that sort of relationship is a fabric of life. And community is about those kinds of relationships, keeping an eye on each other, helping each other. When you're having a really terrible day, you walk into the Continental and someone says to you, "Hi, Bill, how are you doing? Good to see you." That's the kind of relationship that I'm talking about. Now, in terms of what will destroy that, well, if you create a mechanism whereby the idea of development becomes far more important than community and sustaining those relationships, where it's only really about growth and not about the people who live there, then I think that is a recipe and potential recipe for how to ruin the fabric of a community.
Margaret, can we? This isn't just a Seattle or a U District question, right? This tension is all through the Puget Sound area. How do we grow and preserve the restaurant where people know your name and all the other things that makes us think of about a neighborhood?
Well, I would counter with, let's think about what sort of new communities can be created through new development. And here's my example, and I think this feeds into why these two things can coexist. So a couple of years ago, the UW, those listeners who went to law school at UW may have spent a lot of time in Condon Hall on Campus Parkway, a big concrete brutalist building.
Yes.
And the UW repurposed a whole floor of Condon Hall and rented it out to startup companies and tech accelerators, including the region's largest tech accelerator and seed fund, and renamed that part of Condon Hall Startup Hall. And it's been hugely successful in drawing in not only people from elsewhere in Seattle, companies and entrepreneurs, but also as a hub for UW students who come to events, who are doing internships, who are kind of moving back and forth between the classroom and doing cool stuff at these startups. And that's a great model of what sort of the new people that could come in and again contribute to the community. Because one of the things that particularly the young people, but the people of all ages who work in these tech companies, they love going to places like the Continental and other places that had that history, that have that interesting, destinations beyond the office. And I think there's a real opportunity here in the U District to create new communities while sustaining the old.
Tasso, what's the way forward for you? How do you want this city, this region, this neighborhood, how do you want us to handle all the people who, like it or not, are coming here?
Well, you're right. There's going to be, 100,000 folks that are going to be coming in the next decade or so, and something has to be done to house them, to feed them, to move them around the city, to entertain them, et cetera. So that's something that we have to be cognizant of. Well, I guess as I said earlier, we do have to be very aware that there is going to be development and we have to be very smart and strategic about it. But I think that the key for me is actually two. Number one is to remember, again, the discussion on community, and I'm very happy that we're having this discussion. That means that there are other people in the area, in the U District, who are perhaps thinking about it, and the listeners might react and say, you know what, there's a good point being made here. But number two, the thing that I'm most thoughtful about right now is the idea of a public plaza. And that to me would be a very important point to retain the livability of the University District, Bill. And when I say the public plaza, it doesn't necessarily have to be around the metro, the new light rail station at Brooklyn and 43rd, but it just can be anywhere in the area. But what I'm thinking of, and perhaps this is sort of my European background, is of the kind of like the piazza you would see in any ordinary Italian city, or actually for that matter in Greece, where I was born, where you have this central area that invites families, that invites people to come and sit and enjoy each other and have their relationships. And that, to me, is a very, very important point. I remember in the 1970s when the university bookstore was open every Thursday till about, I think, 10 o'clock at night. The Ave was absolutely packed with people, and you would see families and strollers moving up and down the Ave. What a wonderful sight. Well, eventually that went away when the University Heights School was closed. And so the idea of having a public piazza or a public plaza in the U District as an anchor point would be a way for me to... For all of us to attract the families to come back, to have a kind of a magnet for these kinds of new relationships that Margaret is talking about.
Again, Margaret, it's not just the U District or Seattle that's thinking about the piazza or the magnet or the public place. For all of us, I want to know from you, how do we keep our soul while still moving forward?
That's a critical question. And public spaces, plazas, parks, piazzas, streetscapes are part of the marvelous thing about living in cities, that you have these mixing bowls where people can come together and interact informally and be entertained and have some breathing room from regular work and life and routine. But I guess I approach this as someone who teaches and writes about urban history. And I sound a note of caution because we have to think about that sort of park making, space making, place making, whatever you want to call it. You can't do that without addressing underlying questions of economic access, vitality, opportunity, diversity, that you need to have a neighborhood that's working in other ways where you have a wide variety of people, different activities, you have activation, as urban planners call it, of space around the clock. And, you know, a lot of things physically may change in the U District. There may be taller buildings. They will be in only parts of the area. You know, you're not, I don't want anyone to leave this conversation with the impression that there are going to be lots of 30-story buildings in everywhere you can see. But there's this real opportunity to do some exciting and different things and take advantage of the amazing things that already are in the U District. I'm so glad we're having this conversation. I'm so glad that the U District is now a topic of public discussion, because it's this real opportunity to do something novel, different, that responds to the history, responds to the fact that you're next door to this major university with this huge student population. So how do you do this differently and do it right?
Margaret O'Mara, part of the group that created the University District Strategic Plan. She talked there with Tasso Lagos, whose family ran the Continental Restaurant on University Ave for 40 years. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this question. How do we keep what we want and still move forward? Our email address is record@kuow.org. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us. The fate of your state auditor is now in the hands of a jury. Troy Kelly is the man elected to purge government of waste, corruption, and fraud, and he is charged with fraud and tax evasion and money laundering. Before becoming state auditor, Kelly ran a real estate service company. Prosecutors allege he stole millions of dollars from customers. His trial at the federal courthouse in Tacoma wrapped up yesterday. Our Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins has been covering the trial. He told me how prosecutors laid out their case against Kelly.
Basically, what they allege is that over several years, Troy Kelly collected millions of dollars in homeowner fees that were passed along to him by his escrow company clients, who had collected that money at property closings with their clients. And rather than refunding excess dollars, the allegation is that he actually initially did refund that money and then later started pocketing it. And over the course of several years, amassed about $3.5 million in three different bank accounts.
Troy Kelly's defense said the case ought to be viewed as a rotten onion. How did they try to sell Kelly's innocence to the jury?
They tried to sell his innocence by saying a couple of things. One, that this was a case that came about not because some victim came to prosecutors or the FBI and said, look, I was victimized, go after this guy. They pointed out that this came about because Troy Kelly ran for state auditor and his opponent, as part of a political attack on him, brought some of his past business dealings and a civil lawsuit to light, and that's really what triggered a lot of these questions. And so they basically said this was a top-down prosecution that was focused more on getting an indictment and getting a conviction than getting to the truth. And in that sense, defense attorney Angelo Calfo said it's a rotten onion that needs to be tossed out.
You said that the bar for convicting Troy Kelly is going to be high. Why is that?
Well, it is because, you know, this isn't like a classic, you know, bank robbery case or even a classic white-collar kind of crime where you've got victims who were, you know, clearly stolen from or bilked. Because the reality is you do pay these fees willingly, I guess is the right word, when you close a real estate deal. You sign at the bottom of the closing statement saying you understand and you're paying these fees. So the money leaves the hands of the homeowners and goes to the escrow company and then goes to Troy Kelly, and it gets a little bit complicated about whose money was it, what was the role of the escrow companies. They were sort of the pass-throughs. You know, prosecutors will say, don't get too bogged down in those details, that this is pretty simple. It wasn't his to keep. He stole it. He tried to hide it. He tried to evade paying taxes on it, and he needs to be held to account for it. But the defense is certainly doubling down on the idea that this isn't sort of your classic crime.
Austin Jenkins, what surprised you the most about this trial?
You know, I think what surprised me most is that this is the elected state auditor on trial, and yet you could have sat in that courtroom for the last 6 weeks and have almost no awareness of that fact. Essentially, it looked like a, you know, suburban Tacoma dad on trial, not the state auditor. The jury was not frequently reminded by either side of his elected office or even the fact that he's a lieutenant colonel in the National Guard. That did come up a little bit. But really, this trial was very separate from his public office. And to some extent, that makes sense because he's not accused of public corruption. These alleged crimes happened prior to his being elected state auditor. But it really was not like this was a politician on trial.
And what could happen to Troy Kelly if he gets convicted?
If convicted, he faces the potential for federal prison time. I mean, the stakes are very high for him. A felony conviction would automatically vacate his office. He would no longer be the state auditor, and Governor Inslee would appoint somebody until the next election. But it also bears noting that from day one, from the day he was indicted, Troy Kelly has maintained that he will be vindicated. But he has also said that even if he walks away from this and is found not guilty, he does not plan to run for re-election as state auditor this year.
Austin Jenkins, KUOW's Olympia correspondent, joining us from the federal courthouse in Tacoma, where jury deliberations started today in the Troy Kelly case. The state auditor charged on 15 counts, including fraud and tax evasion. This is KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. People in Mukilteo got a remarkable postcard in the mail last week. A plain white card with black box lettering that said, "Attention Mukilteo residents, you may be interested to know, Mukilteo has received a complete planning application for construction of a mosque." And there was an invitation to call Mukilteo's mayor if residents have concerns or questions. The man who reportedly sent the postcard, Mukilteo business owner and resident Peter Zeev, said he has, quote, international and national concerns about the mosque proposal. Mukilteo's mayor, Jennifer Gregerson, told Jeannie Yandel before that postcard went out, the city hadn't gotten much feedback about the mosque.
I've definitely talked to a couple people who had questions about traffic or parking. There's a wetland on the site. It's been vacant for forever, basically. So, you know, a handful of people. The postcard certainly raised a lot more awareness. And so we've had You know, we've had a few dozen phone calls into City Hall and a couple emails. They've really been split. Some of the people, maybe about half, expressing concerns about those, you know, traffic and other issues, concerns and questions about having a Muslim house of worship in the city. And then the other half are people who didn't like receiving the postcard and were concerned about that.
So half of the responses you got were about the mosque and the other half were about just receiving this postcard in the mail.
Right. You know, Mukilteo is growing and changing. And so I think there's always questions when there's new things happening. You know, when I was on our council for 10 years before I became mayor. And, you know, part of that was the economic downturn and there weren't a lot of development applications. You know, it was a very quiet time as far as those issues go. And I think that that's changing. And in a lot of ways, that's really positive. That means that there's, you know, new construction jobs and new growth and, you know, hopefully good developments coming into the city.
Well, as you said, the arrival of this postcard in many residents' mailboxes spurred on a conversation about the building of this mosque. What does that do to the city's plans for going forward with the proposal? How has this affected the city's plans for letting the mosque be built?
Well, our job is to enforce the city regulations and, of course, you know, all other laws. And so we're really focused on that. We're going to make sure that the laws are followed and the regulations are in place and that this development proposal complies with all of those, just like we would with any other proposal. And, you know, there's a First Amendment for a reason. People have a right to exercise their religion. So we can't and we won't discriminate based on that fact.
When you do hear from residents about the mosque, when they're concerned about it being built, what's your response to them?
Well, I let them know that in a review of a land use proposal that it's important to submit their comments about things related to the development. So those traffic and potential wetland impacts, if there's enough parking on the site, those kinds of questions are useful to our planning department as they assess the proposal. And I also remind them that we have the First Amendment and their right to speak out about the mosque is there, as well as the right for people to exercise their religion. And I'm proud that the city is there to ensure that that people are protected and that we're not discriminating as we consider the proposal.
You also may hear from residents who are Muslim or who might look Muslim, who are concerned about what people are saying that this mosque will do to Mukilteo. How do you respond to those concerns?
Well, I really want them to know that our city is a welcoming city, that we're proud of our diversity and that we seek to be inclusive. And so I'm glad that they're in the community and I as mayor welcome them. And I believe that there are many residents in Mukilteo who feel the same way.
Have you had to have that discussion yet with any residents of Mukilteo?
Yeah, a couple times I have. Yeah.
How have they gone?
I think that I've been reassuring to them. And I do feel really strongly that we should be open and welcoming to everyone who wants to be a part of our community. And I want to do what I can as mayor to support that.
Mukilteo Mayor Jennifer Gregerson telling KUOW's Jeannie Yandel about this postcard mailed out regarding a proposed new mosque in the city. The man who reportedly sent the postcard has agreed to meet with local Muslims about it and talk about it. He's indicated he might want to apologize, so we'll keep following that. Here in Washington, you've been able to buy marijuana at the store for almost 2 years, and if you've been doing that, or even buying pot before it was legal, you probably don't need a user's guide to weed. But Seattle writer and performer David Schmader has written one, so I asked him why.
There's the thing of, like, does this need a user's guide? And yes, the basic facts are there, but I guess with the book, I wanted to go beyond basic facts into more etiquette and culture and history and specific effects of weed and particularly what you might do with yourself once you're high. A big thing for me with this book was what I didn't want it to be. And a couple of years ago, I'd been approached to write a book about weed. And I kind of laid down these demands of no cartoon pot leaves, no stoner puns, no forewords by Tommy Chong.
Thank you.
Because that book exists in triplicate all over. And I wanted to write something more like a guide to scotch.
Are you writing for somebody who never smoked pot because it was illegal? And now it's a possibility?
I've learned about this type of person, and I find them very fascinating.
The rule follower.
Yeah. Either they're actual lawyers or people who just didn't like breaking the law. And definitely there's this sense that it's a lot stronger. And this idea that not even past experience can be a really good guide. So even if you did smoke in college, it's kind of a new world. So maybe you'll want some pointers.
Okay, let's start with the newbie. If you're going to start dabbling now because you can, it's legal, at least here, what's your advice? Give me one piece of to-do.
Stick with smoking. It's a very counterintuitive thing. You would think, oh, a cookie is clearly the more benign on-ramp to this experience, but that's not true. Smoking weed, it involves fire, it involves coughing. It's a little grosser than eating a cookie, but the effects land very quickly and they last shorter. When you eat marijuana, it goes through your liver and it gets processed into a different drug that has lightly hallucinogenic properties and lasts for 6 hours. It's a very different experience.
Before we go further, as you say in the book, this is not for children.
Right. Yes. Here's the thing with the book. It's not proselytizing. I don't care if anyone smokes weed except me. Okay, so the government has told us lots of lies about weed. And one of their scare stories that is true is weed is bad for people whose brains and bodies are still developing. It can cause serious problems of either triggering mental illness or learning capability hindrance. This is an adult pleasure.
If you are a grown up and if you have used, but it's been a while, maybe you used when you did illegal things in college, etc., what should you know about 2016 pot?
There was quite a sport to get the highest percentage of THC in the smallest amount of weed because sentences were prosecuted by weight. So there was great incentive to make very, very powerful pot. And that wasn't the case in lots of people. Like, we grew up with that. They called it skunk weed
skunk
and
weed.
Just little grainy stuff. So know that it can be way more powerful. With the recreational market, they're getting smarter about, oh, people want something that is not going to send them to Mars. They would like something close to skunk weed, especially a certain type of person who's just approaching this. So I'm happy that the recreational market is rolling out these strains that are way friendlier.
If you started in on a high and you're having a bad time, what do you do?
Know that no one has ever died from overdosing on marijuana. Know that you will be fine. Maybe take a bath. I always like that one.
A bath.
It takes some time. You have to fill a tub. Maybe you even have to clean the tub before you get in it. It'll just fill up like 40 minutes of your time and you'll calm down. This is a thing I learned on the internet from Neil Young. Apparently, if you're having a big paranoia attack, take black peppercorns, either crunch them in your teeth or smash them and smell them, and it apparently helps people who are prone to paranoia.
Unless you think there's a DEA agent inside the peppercorn. And that could be terrifying. What about pot etiquette? I'm thinking of the party, mm-hmm. where up to now, if I throw a party in my backyard, I don't care that there might be a Mormon there or a teetotaler there. There'll be a cooler full of beer and maybe wine, and they're okay with that. Everybody's okay with that. But I still feel that pot at a party, that might be awkward.
How much of this do you think is even about the smell? Lots of people don't like the smell, and the Mormon at your party doesn't smell your drink necessarily. There is a sense of, oh, now it's a pot party. And certainly there can be, if enough people at a party get super baked, that changes the entire mood of the party. And I could see people who don't enjoy weed resenting that. But there is a strange residue where we're in Seattle. It's legal. It should be exactly like talking about microbrews. But it's not yet. And I think that'll just be us living for a few more years in this and figuring it out on a personal level with your friends. But smoking in your backyard also maybe stinks up your neighbor's backyard if the wind is blowing. There's all these things that kind of make you feel like maybe we should be in the basement with a towel under the door, even though it's legal. I would just like people to have the same ability to make the same poor choices with weed that they make with alcohol.
David Schmader's new book, Weed, A User's Guide, is full of information about medical use and safety and legality and recipes, and you can learn more from David himself tomorrow night because he's going to be at Town Hall Seattle at 7:30. Hi, you're with The Record. on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. April is a time when you see blossoms of poetry around these parts. It's National Poetry Month, and our state's poet laureate, Todd Marshall, is doing public events tonight in Gig Harbor, tomorrow in Whidbey Island, Sunday in Bellingham. KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman wondered how living here in the Pacific Northwest affects Marshall's poetry.
Todd Marshall lives in Spokane, so maybe it's natural that his poetry reflects the landscape around him.
I think I'm blessed in that I get to immerse myself in all these different landscapes. I think my favorite landscape in Washington, and maybe the one in some ways that's connected to my artistic vision, if you will, is the high desert area between Spokane and Walla Walla.
Marshall writes a lot about the high desert, the wildflowers and animal skeletons he finds there. But when I asked him to bring in a short poem, he chose this one. It's inspired by a condo development near his house.
Cage. Listen with tilted head for that first burst of photosynthetic groove, a spitting flow in six sweet, slow, symphonic chords, so close to silence that this spinning planet almost becomes an afternoon in a backyard where morels mysteriously appear from cedar chips spread beneath a porch.
Poet laureate Todd Marshall says he wanted this poem and all of his work to capture the sweep of the cycle of life. He finds that inspiration in Washington State's open vistas. I'm Marcy Silman.
And you can see a video of your poet laureate reading his poem on KUOW's Tumblr feed. Search for KUOW Serial. C-E-R-E-A-L. You can listen to Todd Marshall this weekend at some public poetry events. We're going to tweet details right now at KUOW. And what else? It's going to be cooler and showery this weekend. So here's another indoor activity, the Legacy of Seattle Hip-Hop exhibit at the Museum of History and Industry is still here, but it's almost gone. That closes May 1st. And wherever you're going to be, you might just want to listen to some Prince. In case you haven't heard this, he is gone. One of America's great musicians found dead at his home near Minneapolis, 57 years old. If that makes you feel like watching Purple Rain again, you can do that in Seattle tomorrow night. The Experience Music Project is hosting an all-ages showing of Purple Rain at 6 o'clock and a 21 and over showing at 9:15. And we're tweeting out a link to the EMP Museum website right now. Again, join us on Twitter at KUOW.
I never meant to call.